Hoffman, you have a meeting.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Happy spring. If you're looking forward to a long weekend. We have three things really on the agenda, three topics to cover with you today. The first one is transition management. Second one is cash overlay. And the third one is transaction cost analysis. So, frankly, I find it hard to have these three topics in one meeting because they're so similar and the jargon overlaps that it can get confusing. So if anyone wants to put the brakes on and say, wait a minute, step back, is this what we're talking about, please do. Because it gets confusing for me, too, so I understand.
Yes.
If I could interrupt for just a moment to report that there was no reportable action from the closed session. So that gets on our recorded record. Apologize.
So let's, taking it in order of the agenda, I believe you have printed materials before you. And the first one I'd like to get into is the transition management presentation. So it has the sort of a sunset as far as the first picture goes. And at the bottom it says transition management presentation. So transition management, we have several slides here in the beginning that are a recap from our January educational meeting on this. And the idea is that we are embarking on a transition for the portfolio. That where we are today is the legacy portfolio that we've had for the plan for the past year and even longer. And we've gone through the asset allocation work with you, which presents you with the FFP model, a very different looking portfolio. And we're working out the infrastructure that's going to get us from the old to the new. And so transition management helps us do that, helps us build that bridge and how to do it cost effectively, time effectively to make that happen. So it's not just a case of let's sell out of this mutual fund and let's buy that. It's a little more complex, and that's why we introduced this program. So the program, therefore, has, again, these educational slides give you some of the background in terms of why you'd want to do that. And the real focus, I think, is on page 6, just to recap this. And it really has to do with the incentives and the capabilities of the providers. And here on page 6, the first two columns highlight what a legacy manager is aligned to do and what the target manager is aligned to do. And because, you know, that manager that is losing assets doesn't have a great incentive to give you the best execution possible. They're losing assets. The one acquiring the assets doesn't have a great incentive to give you the best execution because they'll be happy with whatever they got. So once they get it, everything's off and rosy from there. But in transition, a transition manager has their incentives aligned with you. And so that's what we try to highlight on this page. The alignment of interest is large. The expertise, they solely focus on transition management. This is their job. They focus on lowest cost, best execution, best management of opportunity cost or time that you're out of the market or the market might move against you while these trades are being placed. They work on keeping that very tight. They're experts in high volume, big ticket trades. That's very key. Most of your managers are low turnover style managers. This, however, is a big turnover, and so we would want someone with this expertise as well. And they can also do the cross-trade analysis. Because they focus on this in bulk, when we decide to sell a stock, they can look through whatever other transitions they're managing that might want to buy that. If they can cross that trade, then it doesn't have to go through the commission process of placing it on the exchange, so that they can save us money in that way too. So this is what transition management is really designed to do.
Any dangers in that sort of market making role where if they're sort of creating the, you know, they're managing the transition in it and they're identifying within their own pool of other transition work potential buyers? Is there a, I'm not seeing it clearly, but is there a risk there in terms of how they manage that?
Yeah,
to not self deal.
Okay. So I get what you're saying. No, because they are not the principal to the transaction, so they are crossing it with the other clients that they have doing the same thing. So they're working to get best execution for them as well. So they are interested in pairing it and getting it executed that way. So I don't perceive any issue there.
Yeah, I was just trying to think, I'm probably overthinking it, but I'm just trying to understand if there's a risk of not getting the best price because it's more convenient to use someone in their transition stable versus an alternative.
Which is what?
It's a morning of dark scenarios, Ed. I'm just trying to.
Right.
I talked to Ed earlier, and I think one of the things I've always wanted to see us do since I became aware of transition costs is to have it be competitive. In the past, we've had State Street as our bank, and State Street has done, I think, almost all of our transitions. And so they've had the monopoly on it, and I've never felt like we were getting the best deal. I've never felt because there was no competition out there to create the best deal, because they had the monopoly, that we needed to do something about it. So I'm happy we're doing this, and there be the advantage of it, because it looks like we're going to be putting it out to competitiveness, mm-hmm. And so there'll be people bidding on it rather than one system handling all of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we're going in the right direction with this, yeah, and that's why, I think.
How are they compensated? Like, how are they bidding, and is it percent of something?
It is. It's commissions. And so we have a commission schedule in here, so we can take a look at that. I think Jerry raises a good point that whenever we talk about doing a transition, the way the program is contemplated here is that we have multiple providers in each transition category, so that we would put it out to them as a competitive process and get their pre-trade analysis. And that pre-trade analysis is going to give us some clue as to how well they think they can do it. And then once one is selected, they complete the transition, they give us a post-trade analysis that we can then compare back. And so that helps us align it. I think that helps get to it, Scott. I don't think it perfectly answers that, such that you can 100% eliminate that potential. So there is the reliance on the integrity of the firm and being comfortable that they do what they say they'll do. And also, I think today this is a bit more of an educational step along the process, so that when we come back to you next month, we can provide a deeper dive. I think we can look into that particular issue for you and get a...
Yeah, and I didn't want to overthink it. I was just curious about where the checks and balances are to know if that's occurring or...
I think it's very fair. Right.
I mean, these transition managers are in it for the long term. They're not making a huge killing on one transition and then moving on to whatever. Right. I mean, they want a long-term relationship with a client, and if they're not doing a good job with them, they're going to lose that business. So it's not
like a mercenary deal there.
No.
What would one expect to make of this? I mean, give me like a dollar amount. You're saying it's not all that big.
It totally depends on the transition being contemplated, right. So it's highly dependent on that. The pricing that we have is on pages 11 and 12. It's the bottom line there, fees. And so what you're seeing is U.S. equity, 1 to 2 cents per share. Non-U.S. equity, and I'm just picking BlackRock here as an example, 4 to 5 cents a share. Emerging markets higher. U.S. fixed income is done on a basis point, so 3 to 10 basis points, and non-U.S. 5 to 10 basis points.
Ed, one of the things that struck me in reading the fees part is that we don't have any guesstimates against it, the model portfolio that we might be going, that might be going through transition. It doesn't have to be ours perfectly, it just sort of has to model it, but it's the same for each one of these, so that you have some single dollar estimate as to what the cost would be when I go down all of a sudden. I'm not sure what I know now that I know, you know, one's 4.5 and one's 4 plus something and, you know, et cetera.
Right, so. Right. So let's turn back just a couple pages on it.
Seven.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. John, did Harvey have a question?
I'm sorry.
Well, I want to follow up with Scott's question and just ask you, will this manager accept a negative covenant that says that they will not have any financial interest in the transaction other than the commission that we pay them?
I don't know, but we could incorporate that in our search and find out how they respond to that question.
Do they typically have a financial interest in the transaction other than the commission?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they might. Well, I mean, State Street might be a buyer of of our securities that we're selling to put into their portfolio or other clients' portfolios. And that actually saves us money because there isn't a there isn't a sales commission cost there.
Am I right, the crossing network. But we don't know if that's best execution on our behalf.
The sale should go through at the competitive market price, and it's fairly easy to know, through a day.
You know, the transaction takes.
But it's trackable if it's outside the range of.
This is something that comes up in the pre-trade analysis. We get an indication for how a transition manager would approach this, how much they're going to use a crossing network, how they guarantee best execution, how much they intend to trade on the open market, how many days they think they need, and they depend on the post-trade analysis. So it's a little bit difficult to kind of measure this in advance because you're getting bids. You're executing with one partner, and then you're measuring it for that. So this is, understand there's a lot of difficulties embedded here for trying to make this a bit more competitive in the process. You know, get some more information on that. But in terms of the contractual obligations, I can certainly incorporate that into the search.
Yeah, I think generally what we're talking about is if we were to do the transition without a transition manager, we'd clearly be at a gap. There's a gap to be gained here by using one. The question of which one we use and when can be solved with the pre-trade analysis and our general working experience with them on the client service side and what have you over time. I think we'll probably get to like certain ones for certain capabilities more than others, so we'll develop that track record. And I think Harvey's raising a good point similar to Scott's. Let's make sure the incentives are aligned and that we have the proper protections in place to do it. I think that's what I'm hearing from you. So we'll incorporate that in our analysis coming back to you next month.
So is the thought is to have a stable of transition managers, and then for each transition that we present that to each of them, and they come back with a pre-sale estimate,
right,
and we pick the best one given the circumstances.
That's what each transition, or
so maybe I can handle these in a different way. Pages 11 and 12 give us an overview of the providers, and so these are just some factual details about them.
One second, can I take you back to page 7? I just want to know, when you had key considerations in evaluating a transition manager, are these in order of importance that you feel that you feel, or they're just things of, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not in a priority, not in
okay.
a particular order.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Before you leave those pages, just one other question. On 6, I understood almost all the suggestions except under target manager for alignment of interest, they generally request a performance holiday. What does that mean? I just don't understand what that shorthand means.
So as the portfolio comes to them, until it gets fully built out and aligned with their strategy, they're going to ask that we don't really include that in their performance. So they're going to say, you gave me a stock that I wouldn't have a buy on, or I wouldn't hold that much of it. Give me a few days to align it with.
I was going to ask, how long would that holiday typically be? Over a course of days or weeks or months?
It could be up to a month. With the idea that they'd want to have a clean break point so that it's, you know, as of, you know, July 1st or whatever, the beginning of the month. So whenever they get it to them, give us the rest of that month to transition it, and then we'll be clean on.
Can we make that a no greater than? I mean, I could see one of these guys come back a year later saying, I'm not sure why you're measuring my performance. You agreed to give us a holiday.
Well, the transition management process helps get it to there sooner. So because the transition manager is going to look at what the model portfolio for that manager looks like and where they're coming from, they're going to build that process in so that it does the buys and sells, so when they get it, it is clean and you don't have the performance holiday then.
Don't have it. Okay.
Right. So,
but if there is one, is there a way that you can put a fence around it?
Or the portfolio? There is, but if you're using a transition manager, you preclude that entire conversation because the portfolio you're delivering to the target manager is the portfolio they want. They have no excuse to ask for a performance holiday. The day they receive the portfolio, it is fully built to their specs.
So not to beat a dead horse, but what we're saying here is that we wouldn't allow them to have that provision as a target manager then?
Right. So basically, why transition manager as a target manager? This is like, if you just give if we took manager A's portfolio and we said, manager A, we're terminating you, we're hiring manager B.
Right.
Manager B, you will receive manager A's portfolio. Manager B says, it's not my portfolio, I can't be held accountable
right.
for, you know, getting it to my point. That's the performance holiday. If we put into this gap a transition manager who delivers that target portfolio, there's no target holiday that should ever be requested, and we would not grant one.
Would not grant one. That's the key part I'm looking for. Okay.
Yeah, so this slide is set up to show why you don't want the target manager managing that transition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
At some point, I raised the modeling of a fee and a single number, and you started to go back to something, and we went down a different path for a while.
We did about four different paths. I'm coming back to it.
We were hazy paths, right?
I think to answer your question, John, it really comes out in the pre-trade analysis. So let me get to why that is the case. So we started to go down the path of 11 and 12 as the managers. We'll come back to that in a moment. Page 17 is the program. Page 17 has three basic groups here. And as we think about this initial transition from the legacy portfolio that we have today to the FFP world, we would categorize that as a complex multi-asset class transition, which is the third bullet point here. And this is because it involves moving monies across equities, domestic and international. It involves fixed income. It involves all asset classes. And there aren't many providers that are capable of doing that. Citigroup and Russell are the two we would recommend for considering that kind of a transition. Thus, we provided you with some details on those two firms. Going forward, we might have additional transitions that are simpler. And the top one is the most straightforward, direct and indirect U.S. equity, meaning that it is the transition here would only be in U.S. equity buckets. And direct or indirect is whether we're saying we want to go from a direct would be like a large cap growth manager to a large cap growth manager. This is direct. We're just changing managers for whatever reason. Indirect would be large cap growth to something else, maybe, you know, large and mid cap or something core. So similar but different. And so we would want to have a transition manager involved here. And the companies outlined that are better at doing that, Pensera, Russell, and Virtus. And then direct non-U.S. equity, indirect non-U.S. equity, and U.S. fixed income, these get to be a little bit more complex. And here we would have BlackRock, Citigroup, and Russell involved. So the idea is that in a program like this, Contra Costa County, Cesera, would have an arrangement with each one of these providers as a master agreement, kind of an evergreen agreement. So you have this agreement in place already that's been approved, reviewed by legal, everything's good, you have that. A transition comes up and you say, oh, okay, it falls into this category. Here's the providers we use for that category. Let's go get the pre-trade analysis from those providers. And because you have the agreement in place, they can do that very quickly. So it just expedites that process. And then there's an individual term sheet for that transition. So if you like the pre-trade analysis and that's the one we want to select, we sign the dotted line and we're good to go. So it creates that framework.
Do we pay them at that point for that pre-trade analysis for each one?
You don't pay them for a pre-trade. It's only when the trade has been executed.
Good questions. Thank you. So Evergreen is the contract, the pre-contract that they all agreed to before.
That's
we
right.
engage with them.
Yeah,
okay.
Master agreements.
And it's like a general contract. It's not really specific.
Right.
Okay.
It's that you've already established.
Because I had defined Evergreen. I never heard of that before. So
yeah.
Now I know.
Garbage thing.
Huh?
Garbage contracts.
It's a contract.
Oh yeah, this is very good.
It never ends.
You would know that, right?
Yeah. So that's why I pointed at Scott because sometimes.
We should go to you.
We have a really long contract.
You ready to develop our Evergreen contract?
Oh, sure. We're kind of skipping around again. It's not your fault. But are we done with pages now up to 17? Or are you going to go back?
I do want to go back.
Because I had a couple questions on 11 and 12.
Yes. Yes. So let's get into 11 and 12. So now you see how we would align these and what they would be used to do. There are a couple notes I want to make here, though. And it's really on page 12. We included State Street and Virtus in here. Neither of these providers are Verus focus list providers. When we work with a client and we suggest which ones to work with, these two typically are not offered. So we were asked to include them in this search. One is because State Street is your custodian, and there is a natural benefit to using your custodian, typically, generically in this business, because there is a process of setting up transition accounts, and the custodian already is your custodian, so it's very easy for them to set up those transition accounts. It saves you on the administrative overhead. There's also a process of reconciling the securities in the portfolio. Again, because they're your custodian, they have that reconciled. It's very quick and easy for them to do it. And you have a positive working relationship with them, so your experiences have generally been favorable. So all of those are good reasons to include them. We highlighted last time in their timeline that they had some issues with transition management in the UK. The FSA investigated those. The FSA went through their process and identified that some of those issues tie back to their US leadership. Our concern is that the issues that fall under the US leadership fall out of the FSA's jurisdiction, so they did not take any further action with regard to those. And we've never really gotten comfortable that the issues have been properly addressed. And so that gives us pause with using them. Now, that dates back some time, and you've actually had positive transitions with them since those times. So that's our caveat on that, on using State Street.
And on Virtus, what was the issue?
Virtus, we highlighted on the timeline with Virtus that they were formerly named GTS. They renamed themselves Virtus, and they changed their domicile to Baltimore. Changing domicile in and of itself isn't a big deal. They're part of a brokerage. All these use broker-dealer licensing to complete what they do. They're part of a broker-dealer that has an arm that is more traditional broker-dealer in terms of agents working with individual consumers. Within that world, there is an individual that has regulatory issues. Their FINRA filing has several criminal issues that give us pause. What we've gotten from Virtus is a written letter saying that individual is solely on the brokerage side, does not touch transition management, separate businesses entirely. In fact, that's a Percival Trading is a different company within the Virtus ownership. It ties back to one gentleman that you see here. Ken Taylor is listed here. He is the CEO, 100% owner of the firm, and it happens to be his son who's on the one with the track record. So that gives us some pause there.
Wow. Ed, do you have any more information for both State Street and Virtus about particular allegations or claims or particular alleged misconduct?
So, not with me. I don't have the details with me. If you
not with what?
I don't have those with
They're
me.
Not available today.
Yeah.
State Street had an issue with it was the London branch, and it was fixed income, and it was pricing on fixed income securities.
Yeah, it was for UK based transition for UK based clients in fixed income. The pricing traditions in the UK are a little bit different than they are in the US. It can be priced on
timing,
spread or fixed fee. It came out that some of the traders had charged both spread and fixed fee when it should have been one or the other in the UK. And so the FSA investigated that, sanctioned the firm. I think the individuals were all fired who were associated with that. But it's highlighting that the FSA noted that the UK operations were overseen by the US operations, and the question is, while the UK operations were addressed, was leadership in the US properly restructured?
And the meeting that we had with State Street in Boston that time, they talked about the person who was in charge of the UK trading. There was an issue there with regards to him hiding information from other parts of the company. Mm-hmm. And so the people that we spoke to in Boston claimed kind of ignorance until this came to light, whether or not he was really, really good at hiding it or and where the money was going. Because the money was going
he and his group were benefiting from this as far as commissions and bonuses and other compensation. So they were the ones who were directly benefiting from this, if I remember correctly.
And in a very dilutive manner, yes.
Yeah, true. But the higher up you are, the more...
Yeah, I don't want to put words in Barris's mouth, but I think it comes down to an issue of the U.S. operations should have known.
Should have known, right.
And is that kind of the assessment that the oversight structure wasn't properly reformed?
Yes, I think that's right. And we were... I don't believe we ever got comfortable with what the SEC did with them to, SEC apparently investigated this, but did not come out with any findings on it. And it never was clear as to what actions were actually taken, what the SEC did find, or what their investigation concluded. So it kind of left a cloud of unknown over the whole thing.
I'm not sure whether the SEC had jurisdiction over what happened in the portion of the business that was UK. Based, so it was kind of European regulators did what they could do, and the SEC did what they could do, and the SEC.
So you're still referring to State Street?
Yes, yes. Coming out of that meeting, I felt much more comfortable with how State Street handled this once this came to light, and the new regulations and whatever internal regulations and policies that they put into place. But it was pretty blatant that they were basically charging them twice,
right,
for these transactions. And I forget exactly how it came to light. I mean, maybe it was one of the clients that goes, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't, this doesn't look right."
And let me just finish a couple comments on Virtus. So Ken Taylor Jr., Ken Taylor Sr. is the relationship there that draws some attention. As you know, Virtus is a common provider that we see at Sackers, and they have been used by other Sackers counties, which Varis consults to. Our experience with them has been very favorable. I think Scott's words are exemplary, that they've really done an excellent job of the project management, pre-trade analysis, and the execution. So the actual results, again, here have been very favorable, recognizing that.
What other 37 ag counties use the Veritas?
I believe it was Tulare and Imperial, but I can look that up.
So there's two counties that you know of?
Yes.
Okay. And they're saying, okay, they feel comfortable?
Those are the two counties that we consult to that use them. I don't know about the other Sackers counties.
Right. Would you describe again the criminal act and punishment for the sin?
Oh, yes. It has to do mainly with drugs.
Okay. All right. So it's not... cheating in his work. It's not a defalcation of client monies.
That's right.
All right.
That's right. It's more of the personal poor judgment.
Presumably when young?
When young. And probably not all that long ago.
Careful now.
Within the past 10 years.
Within the past 10 years. Well, because he's young to us.
Young is a relevant term.
But it was a personal act, nothing to do with the company.
Correct. It wasn't anything like embezzlement or something like that.
The only negative, he's got a felon. Felony. So that's, I think, what the issue, right?
Yeah.
The fact he's a felon.
That's right.
This isn't Madoff, then.
No, it's not Madoff.
Can be, grand theft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The U4 forms are what FINRA uses. U4 can be pulled up pretty easily, so we could probably get that to you in a matter of minutes and have the specifics on that.
There were a couple things on the chart. First, it may be a typo or just left out, but on Veritas, you don't have any experience data or years with the firm. Either they're all fresh out of school or you just forgot it's page 12.
Oh.
And I didn't know if it was left off intentionally or it was just a mistake.
That's just a mistake.
Okay. And secondly, on State Street and Citigroup, I'm not sure how we're going to be in a position to compare when there's no fee schedule for either one of those two organizations. It's sort of like going to a car dealer and having them say, "I'll let you know when you drive it out."
Yes, and both those organizations are very large with a lot of flexibility, so it's somewhat of what we can negotiate and somewhat of the pre-trade analysis. So this is you know, each one of these is indicative pricing. I think we can work to negotiate these. I think with the smaller providers, we're not going to have much negotiation. That's kind of what they give us. With the larger providers, I think we can get more detail when we come back to you with the.
But I'm not sure how they see this as being responsive to an RFP or an RFI by just saying, you know, we can talk later.
Because it's an RFI, because it's information, and they're saying that once you talk to us about the specifics of what you're thinking, we'll give you better pricing on it. So they'll be responsive once we tell them.
And it'll come up in the pre-trade step. They would tell us what their fees are going
to
be there.
Yeah, but it seems to me there's more transparency on the part of the other firms at this point in the process by saying where they are. And the other guys are saying, trust us, we'll talk to you later. We're big and we can work with you. I'm not comforted by that lack of information at this point in the process.
And there is, just to be clear, there is an intermediate step between what we're talking about today and the final selection. So this is saying what they provided to Verus to date is, here's our assessment, here's our indicative pricing. And some folks are saying, you need more specifics to give you indicative pricing. There's another step that says, okay, now you're under, you know, we're farther along the process, we'd like to engage you, give us final pricing structure. And then there's even another step after that where we do the pre-trade analysis and say, now on this transition, on these securities, final pricing, so we can compare you to your peers. So we're a little bit earlier in the process. I agree, some people provided it, that was better.
Yep.
The folks who didn't, but there's another chance to get harder pricing before we do final.
In terms of feedback, it seems to me they ought to be told that
when
that's fine to talk about it later, but you were asked for information at this point and you ducked it, and that's not cool.
Ed, when you were creating this report, and I mean, it's clear, I understand what Jerry's asking about. It's clear that they're not stated. Did you go to them and say, hey, you know, we have quotes from Russell, but we don't have anything from you, State Street, or from Veritas. Can you give us what you consider your, you know, minimum fees are?
To be fair, no. So this was an RFI process.
I mean, when I did this, I ran across the same thing Jerry's talking about. I said, wait a minute, they're not listed. And I understand that we will get that down the line. But it's kind of nice to see at least where their ballparks are.
Agreed. And part of this, in putting together the program and understanding who we would use for what, is part of what we want to get some consensus built on today.
All right.
That will allow us to go back to them and say, here's what we're thinking of with you.
Yeah, I just want to confirm that when the TMs present their pre-trade analysis, they have not seen the legacy portfolio and the target portfolio, or they have seen it.
They have to have it to
then
do
they
that
should
analysis.
Have a sense of how much they the commission, at least because those are the explicit charge or
that's
cost.
Right. That's exactly right.
So right now, we're kind of not vetting necessarily price. The prices are relatively going to be comparative, or they're not going to be able to stay in business. We're looking at expertise, longevity, and various other internal type workings of these firms to initially set up this portfolio or stable of potential managers. And then when we actually get down to cost, they can quote these costs, but it's really the pre-trade or pre-transition analysis that is going to be the nuts and bolts of what they're saying, a given. That's going to be the comparison that we want to make, not numbers that they're quoting here and in a vacuum.
Yes, and even when we get to that pre-trade analysis, I think we'll take a look at those and there is some qualitative decision making there as well too. So it won't purely be on a dollars and cents basis. You wouldn't want it to be. There will be more thoughtful approaches and better client service models and what have you. So that'll have to be.
I'm back on my same horse just for a moment.
Okay.
We are going to get sometime before a decision is made a set of numbers that as a practical matter we as a board can look at. And if one is 10,000 and the other is $500,000, we're going to recognize that as the cost, the transition cost that the transition manager would expect to bill us.
Yes.
We're going to get the basis points and cents per share, and they're all over the place. I mean, I look at that and I have no idea.
John,
how it comes up.
you're never going to get to a hard number that the board's going to see in advance and engage with. What you're going to get to is vetting the pools. And the pools are going to allow you to get more than one number. So when we show a transition and we say it's in XYZ asset class, there are two or three vendors that are pre-approved, we go out to them and we get the pre-trade analysis. Now they'll say, we expect to trade this percentage of the portfolio in the open market at this rate, with this opportunity cost. We expect another portion that we can cross with other clients, no commission cost, a crossing network, and we can start to kind of see what's their game plan, what's the implementation cost, what are the explicit fees, and it's kind of a qualitative assessment. And then we go through the process, we get a post-trade analysis. It's like, how well did I do relative to my expectations going in? So we can report back to the board after the fact, but there's never going to be you're never going to see a report that says going from portfolio A to portfolio B will be done for a fixed fee of $10,000. Because we don't know where the market's going to be moving.
Each day.
It is in the moment assessment of where we get greatest liquidity and best execution. And then there'll be a post-trade analysis that allows staff to say, relative to our expectations going in, was this a positive or a negative outcome? And then when we do the next bid, we'll have that kind of in our quiver of saying, we had a positive or negative outcome with one of the managers in the pool.
I guess it's those expectations going in that I'm sort of narrowing my own question down to. We're going to have we have maybe three firms that we're looking at to select one. Mm-hmm. We've got a set of expectations on all three, that we've got some ability to make a judgment about where we expect things to be, even though, as you're describing, but we may not actually
basis points would tell us.
Sure.
Since we're talking about a model and pre-selected vendors, we're using the word we a lot. I think need to maybe start using identifying board, Varis, and staff, because at least the way I understand it, this model, it would entail the board making a selection of one or more vendors in a future meeting. We would enter into contracts with those. Mm-hmm. Then we would have
the pre-approved list of vendors.
The board would have that, but once that's done, it would be Varis and staff, or Varis only, I'm not sure, actually looking into each transition manager and what they can provide for the transition, comparing their data analyses and their fees and making a selection, and possibly reporting back to the board.
So,
is that correct?
So the master agreements would be set up between Sasera and the providers, and that would definitely involve board discussion. We could do, for the next meeting, I think we could do an example of a pre-trade analysis, and that might be able to answer some of your question, John, and take a look at it that way as an example. You could see the dollar amounts involved and what we're talking about, and I think that might help guide who should have discretion to make that decision then. If we're talking about a large cap growth manager to a large cap growth manager, it's going to be a pretty small dollar amount, relatively speaking. And you might say we're comfortable with staff or Varis or some combination doing that, take care of it, report back. If we're going from today's portfolio to FFP, you might see a multi-million dollar transition, and you might say we'd like to be involved in that. Does that sound reasonable?
So trying to piggyback on this, back to your example, Tim, mm-hmm. as we, that is the board, we look at the choices, is there an evaluative basis among, say, three vendors to at least make a judgment about which of the three appears to have the more either cost-effective proposal or whatever? Because I think, at least as I interpreted John's question, part of it was I'm trying to understand, aren't we going to be able to make some kind of a way to know which one looks to be the best deal without having to wait till the end and then have them redefine victory for us and tell us how wonderful it was?
So when we do a transition, we'd be going out to this
point. That's what I meant to say, by the way.
Understood. The advantage of having the pool is you're getting pre-trade analysis from each one of those. That's with dollars tied up. So we're not going to have dollars tied out in an absolute sense on a fixed fee basis, but for each discrete transition, you will have 2 to 3 bids or apples to apples comparisons.
Okay.
Make a selection, go through the process, measure them according to the pre-trade analysis. So the pre-trade analysis is your apples to apples dollar.
And that's the benchmark of which, against which they're going to be made.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
And who's going to make that selection?
I view that as an operational piece. I mean, I want the board's buy-in on this. I mean, it's kind of fleshing out an idea of a dollar limit. To me, this is an operational piece. I'm open to having that conversation, but I think typically speaking, we want the board's buy-in on choosing the pool. Once the board's made a decision to go from portfolio A to portfolio B, it's a cost-effective basis. I think in the past, that's been a staff function. You're more than happy to report out if the board feels you need to be involved on some of these bigger ones. Let's have that discussion.
And I'm wondering, in absence of having that pre-trade analysis for the board to consider, is it possible to have kind of a plain vanilla, you know, really simple asset mix and kind of an example of, okay, if we go with this manager, this is what it would potentially look like, this manager, knowing that, okay, this isn't our portfolio and this isn't the fee that we're going to have, but just for, you know, illustration purposes
just
for the board.
What it's going to look like?
I mean, is that something, I mean, that might assist the conversation?
Yeah, at least that way we can get an example. We can talk about why pieces on there move relative to market conditions and kind of just engage. This is the messy operational side.
and we are all talking about something, at least from where I sit, some of us don't know a whole lot about, right? So I'm happy to admit that. So it to me, it's like we're talking about some abstraction that I really can't get my arms around. Some of us know, I know a lot more experience on this board than some of us have, but so to me, we're talking about this sort of abstract concept.
Yeah, this not always.
This happened behind the scenes historically. It has gone through State Street. They have been our go-to. We've gotten the pre-trade, post-trade analyses through that process. Now it's being illuminated for the board, and you're asking some good questions here. But let's have Jarrett return with a sample so you can see.
After you see the pre-trade analysis, you may not want to see another.
That's right.
This is not like, this is how much it's going to cost.
Be careful what I wish for.
Yeah. Pieces that.
But I do think that with the transition to the new portfolio mix, I think that, you know, we are going to be transitioning a number of dollars. And this is kind of an anomaly for our plan, and I think it is important we have an apples-to-apples comparison of the fees, and the board has a good understanding of what each of the transition managers are bringing to the table.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we're really trying to get that process nailed down before we start moving money around.
Again, I'll go back to what I said very early on. I am in favor of the fact that we'll have more than one person doing all the transactions, that it's put out there, and we'll get to see three or 4. It's like almost like an RFP, and I've always been in favor of that competitive stuff going on, and us getting to look at what we think is would be good. And I think we're heading in that direction. Is mm-hmm.
Ed, on Russell, are they in the process of being sold or been sold? And are these personnel going to stay with that company, or are they going to be gone, or?
Yeah, so Russell's transition management business is not an issue for us from that perspective. That is a concern with their cash overlay, which we'll be talking about in a minute. So the personnel changes, we don't think it's going to be an issue for them.
But are they going to be sold? Are they coming?
Well, I'm looking here. It says group will be owned by TA Associates and Reverence Capital
and
Partners.
Reverence
so that
Capital
tells
Partners.
Me they're being.
Yes.
Sold, or are they going to be taken over by them? Or?
They are in the process. So TA and Reverence announced the deal. The deal has not closed yet. So they're in the process of doing that. It's supposed to close, I believe, first half of this year. So we should know more pretty soon.
So we'll know more.
Yeah. This is the whole Russell organization?
No, because the London Stock Exchange kept the index business. And they London Stock Exchange bought the whole thing, kept the index business, I believe, and are selling off the rest, the consulting and the asset management pieces.
Okay, but so Russell 2000 and what have you will index will.
Oh, those will stay off, yeah.
Okay.
Those are the cash cows that London Stock Exchange wanted to keep.
Little did you know you'd be quizzed on so many aspects of what
Let me give you a chance to finish anything you want to say on item 4, and then we can go to the
Yes, so conceptually, page 17, I think, is the real key here, because this is the outline of the program, or the skeleton, that will put some more meat on the bones for the next meeting. But, you know, going back to this concept of how are we going to select, you'll see that we have three providers identified for the first one, direct and indirect U.S. equity. Assuming we move forward with all three, we would then be able to get competitive bids from those when we identify a direct and indirect U.S. equity transition event. Similarly, for the second one down, we have three providers there. And for the third one down, we have two providers there. So that's the concept. So the recommendation that we're making is that the board does indeed authorize Verus to conduct the search so that we bring you back the additional details on these providers, assuming these are the providers you want us to consider, or if there are any changes given our discussion on State Street and Virtus. And
motion, John.
And then does utilize this approach, if you're comfortable with this approach, for soliciting the competitive bids for them.
Yeah, I've got a motion, but I like the process. I like what we're doing. So my